are Twitter, texting, and emoticons, taking the place of clear communication and proper grammar? Well, not really. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Sometimes you may read a sentence or even write one of your own and know there's something not quite right with that sentence, but you're not sure what. Well, it could be grammar. I've been following the blog of the Grammar Diva for the past few years simply because I enjoy writing and crafting sentences. I've wanted to talk with the person behind the blog, so finally today, we visit with Arlene Miller, more commonly known as the Grammar Diva. With a comma or a dash, it's a novel idea. Arlene Miller is an author, editor, teacher, and grammarian who speaks on the subject to an array of clients and audiences. The best little grammar book ever is her award-winning bestseller, which she followed up with Correct Me If I'm Wrong. She ain't no schoolmarm, and she tolerated my need for a little grammar therapy. Arlene Miller, you are the Grammar Diva.
Yes, I gave myself the name, if you're going to ask where it came from.
I think we should start there. We're going to talk about grammar, and we're going to talk about your books. But to say that you're the Grammar Diva means that you're into grammar and that you like it and think you're really good at it.
I love grammar. I have always loved grammar. I loved Latin. And I've always been a language person.
To the point where you decided to write books about it.
It kind of evolved. I started out in journalism, did a little newspaper work, eventually became a technical writer, didn't want to get more technical, so I switched over to being a technical editor. And then I found myself leaving that, raising a family, and I didn't get back into technical writing. And a couple of people said, oh, you'd be a good teacher. So I went at a ripe old age and got a teaching credential. And for the past 11 years, taught English. And it was a combination of starting teaching and the copy editing where I said, you know, I keep seeing the same mistakes over and over again. I'm going to write a book and put all those mistakes in them. And that's how the first book came about.
And that's the best little grammar
book
ever?
That's the best little grammar book ever, which came out in May 2010.
101 ways to impress with your writing and speaking. And I was going to ask you about this because writing and speaking both involve grammar. And I know I tend to hone my writing and find when I am clumsily using language, but I don't have that facility in my brain all the time. So I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about speaking grammatically correct and writing?
It's different. There's formal English and there's informal English, and you're really not expected to use all the grammar rules when you talk to your friends. It's not necessary. Probably a good habit, because then when you write, you will use the formal grammar. But even in writing, you know, I would recommend to anybody to use the strictest of rules if you're writing a cover letter or a college essay. Because even if something is sort of a rule that's fading away, the person who's reading it may not know it's fading away and may really be a stickler for grammar. So it's always best to err on the side of conservatism. When speaking, obviously, if you're presenting a speech and you're the president or you're some kind of a prepared speech, you want your grammar to be perfect. And many people, when you listen to the news now, it's not perfect. I probably speak a lot better than I used to. I actually sort of speak more formal, so people would laugh at me. I actually do say sometimes "for whom," and most people don't. And one thing, I'm just reading a book now about grammar. Nobody else would find it interesting, probably. It's about the history of people writing grammar books and Webster. And I'm not very far into it, but people are talking about who and whom and getting rid of the distinction and ending sentences with prepositions, and it's okay now. That argument has been going on since the 1700s. It started back then. I didn't realize that, but it did.
So some of these issues have been around for a while, and I wonder with the tweeting and texting, how that has changed how we communicate in writing, or does it have an effect at all on formal writing?
From what I've read, it apparently doesn't. It really doesn't. I think people know the difference, and usually if people write well, they use proper English in tweeting as well. And, you know, Facebook, I see a lot of blunders in Facebook. But it's not because it's informal. It's just because, you know, some people make these grammar mistakes everywhere.
Okay, so you were inspired to write the best little grammar book ever, perhaps because you saw a void.
Yes.
And then you wrote Correct Me If I'm Wrong?
Yes. That came about. I didn't plan to write another grammar book because once you write a grammar book, how many can you write? Well, I've discovered you can write quite a few. It's an odd way the second book came about. I was on Facebook and a writer friend of mine, a novelist, put on Facebook, "I had a dream last night that you wrote a book called Correct Me If I'm Wrong." And I said, you know, that's a really good title. I think perhaps I'll write another grammar book. So it's similar than the first one, but it's got emphasis in different areas, and it is arranged differently. It's arranged all alphabetically by common mistake.
By common grammatical
mistake. Grammatical mistakes, including punctuation, word usage, which I kind of all include in grammar.
And beyond worksheets, what's this?
That's another person telling me to write a book. This is before even the first book. I had a student teacher several years ago, and she said, "Wow, your grammar lessons are really good. You should put them together in a book." So it's not a print book. It's just an ebook or a PDF. And it's outdated now because it doesn't contain any technology. But it's lesson plans that I used for my students so they wouldn't be bored with grammar. They're seventh graders, although it's probably good for 6 through 12. And I also had adaptations for people who homeschool and don't have a whole group of kids. And it's been on Kindle, and it's been on a teacher site, and it's gotten a lot of positive comments and still does on the teacher site, even without the technology.
Because teachers need tools.
Yes. Teachers always need ideas, and a lot of them don't really love teaching grammar.
Nor students like learning
Nor
it.
Nor do students like learning it, although I had pretty good success trying to make it palatable.
You, before we got on the air, you talked about you have a novel out, too. I think we must mention that.
I have a novel. I wrote it during NaNoWriMo, which, for those who don't know, it's National Novel Writing Month. It's every November, where the goal is to write a 50,000-word novel in 30 days. And I thought about doing it for a couple of years, and then in 2011, I did it. And there's two ways you can write a novel. You can have a plan and have an outline, or you can, quote, pants it, unquote, and figure, okay, I've got some kind of an idea. I'll sit down and it will write itself. I attempted to do the it will write itself. It did write itself. Not only did it write itself, but at about 42,000 words, it turned in a direction that I never would have expected it to, and I went along with it. And then since I'd gone through the trouble of writing it, about 51,000 words in 24 days, I published it. And it's hard to publish, it's hard to promote a novel, especially when you're writing in a completely opposite genre and when it's under a pseudonym. And I put it under a pseudonym because it's called Trashy Novel, and I was a seventh grade teacher. So it is under a pseudonym, which I will, it's JoJo Baker, which I did with using a pseudonym formula. Although I, it's, if you look up my name on Amazon, this book also comes up. It is, it has some, it's not graphic, but I thought Trashy Novel was a good name for a novel, and I would like to do some sequels to it, but not, haven't had the time yet, but it was fun.
Well, maybe next November.
Some November, I will do it.
So I want to talk with you a little bit more about grammar and the distinction of, or the relationship between grammar and vocabulary. For instance, moot and mute. This isn't a grammatical error, but it's very annoying when people use the term, it's a mute point, which, you know, I guess could mean something, but I know that's not the phrase that they really mean. And they really mean moot. And it's just maybe how we learn language and we think we know what a word means. But so what's the relationship between grammar and language? Vocabulary, I should say.
I include it. Some people say grammar is simply syntax, the way you put sentences together. But most grammar books have punctuation, and mine has also word usage, those many, many words that people get confused. The workbook that I just did has a whole chapter on those confusing words. Something like moot and mute is more, I think, the way people hear things, because there are lots of those, they're kind of, I forget what they're called, but something like, for all intents and purposes, some people hear it and say it for all intensive purposes. And there are lots of those, and they're not really usage. They're just kind of mishearing.
And that is how we acquire language,
yes,
is often just through hearing,
right,
and context.
Right.
And we make it up. You,
right,
know, it's
and we repeat what we hear, how our families talked,
right,
how people in our regions spoke.
Yes, yes. I wonder if you might say that the basis of all grammatical constructions or sentences, or is the sentence the basic grammatical construction, and is it, can we reduce it down to a subject and a verb? A noun and a verb, a subject and a verb.
The way I start teaching is with the parts of speech, of which there are about eight, depending on, you know, what you call a part of speech, and then going into, what do you need to make a sentence? You need a subject and you need a verb. And actually, all you really need is a verb. You can have a one-word sentence. If you tell your dog to sit, that's a sentence, sit. Because there is a subject and a command, but it isn't there, and it's you, which is called the implied you in parentheses. So you need a subject and a verb at minimum, and then from there you add on adjectives to describe the noun and adverbs and maybe conjunctions to tie things together. And then from there I go on and I teach phrases, which are little groups of words that make your sentence more descriptive, and from then clauses, which are bigger groups of words that have subjects and verbs, but sometimes are not complete sentences, and they just make your writing more interesting because you can have different constructions and not all your sentences start with a subject followed by a verb.
When grammar is being taught these days in school, is the sentence diagramming. Is that something passé? Is that a thing of the past?
Yes, except in religious schools. I think St. Vincent, I got a student from there. Some schools still, they used to be called parsing, I guess. When I was in school, we diagrammed sentences. In the grammar book that I used when I taught, it was in the very back that so nobody could see it. I started doing it, but then I kind of would have had to relearn it. But people who learned it really know their grammar. It really does seem to help. No, they're not doing it anymore. They're not really teaching too much grammar anymore. A lot of people are of the notion that grammar should be taught as part of literature rather than discreetly as its own thing, and I really think it should be taught as its own thing. I feel as if, and I think I wrote this in a blog post, it's like trying to hide the broccoli in the mashed potatoes so nobody will notice that they're learning it. But I think the language is fascinating and it's on its own, and it should be taught on its own because it's more than just writing and speaking. It's our language.
It's power.
It's a topic. It's our language, and it's interesting to learn about, just like it's interesting to learn about history or science.
I find it interesting that when I, as an adult, have studied foreign languages, finding the verb tenses in foreign languages and even how nouns are in foreign languages made me reflect upon how much I took for granted in my own language, speaking English, and my own understanding of how I'm using things. And verb tenses is one of them. And I wonder if you can maybe give us a little advice or tell us the differences. And I want to give a few examples just that I came up with. Like, I am going out tonight. I will be going out tonight. I want to be going out tonight. I want to go out tonight. That there are nuances to meaning, but also what are those nuances and why would we choose I am going, I will be going, when we might mean the same thing? Or is it something that maybe we shouldn't have to think too much about in conversation, but when we are writing it, that we might want to be more discriminating? I don't know. Just give me your thoughts.
Well, there are in English 12 tenses. And tense obviously is time. There's the past, of course. There's the present and there's the future. And then there's the present perfect, which is, if you use I walk, it's I walk. The past is I walked. But the present perfect, which is also in the past tense, is I have walked. Now, what's the difference between I walked and I have walked? There actually is a difference. I have walked means I've done it and I might still be doing it. Whereas I walked, it's over. So there is sometimes some mistake made that probably nobody would notice, but they are different. And then there's the way back one, I had walked, which is it happened in the past before something else that happened in the past. And then there's the future, I will walk and I will have walked, which is the future perfect, which is in the future before some other time in the future. Then those are six tenses, and then there are six more, the same six, but with the ing, which are called the progressive. And those are the ones we actually usually use when we talk. I am walking. You don't usually say I walk. You say I am walking. When you say I want to walk, the verb changes. And the verb there isn't walk anymore. The verb is want. And the to walk is an infinitive. And it's no longer a verb at all. If you think about the sentence and its structure, an infinitive is actually a noun. So it gets really complicated. It's called a verbal phrase.
I want to be walking.
I want to be walking.
The to be.
I want to be walking. I want is the verb. To be walking.
This wasn't a...
That might be a gerund. I guess, have to think about
no,
that
this,
one.
I don't want to... It wasn't meant to be a pub quiz, but...
It's a complicated
I
one.
Find that sometimes in my own writing that I use to be a lot, that I have to then clean it up. Because
it's kind of wordy with to be.
Yeah, and I'm not sure why I do that, but it made me wonder about I want to be walking tonight.
Well, you could say I want to walk, and I guess you'd have to know the rest of the sentence to see which makes sense. Because usually when we talk, you know, there is a slight distinction in what we in the meaning, and we may need those other words.
Yeah. I think it's part of the joy of writing to be able to determine the nuance that right. comes from that kind of word choice.
The language is very flexible.
Yes, yes. Placement of adverbs and the split infinitive, and maybe the split infinitive is something that is also passé, but and I don't like to talk so much about my own writing, but it's something that I struggle with in my own writing, and I think I'm not going to do that. And then I wonder if, again, could you just comment on that, and do you have thoughts about that?
You can do it. It's okay. It started with Star Trek, to boldly go where no man has gone before, and it is okay. And not only is it okay, I think it's okay with the most conservative of us. It's really fine to split an infinitive. There really is no problem at all.
Well, sometimes when I'm assessing what I am trying to say in my writing, I wonder if there is, again, this slight difference in the color of what is being expressed by making those choices. And perhaps it's at the core of personal style, then, if it's acceptable either way, then maybe part of it is just the creation of style in writing. I don't know.
And especially with an adverb can many times be placed at multiple places in the sentence without really changing it.
But maybe emphasizing.
Right. And sometimes if you have an adverb like only, it very much depends where you put it in the sentence. I have a series of sentences where if you move only around like, you know, 8 or 9 times, it's completely different.
I also, just in your saying that, I tend to use just a lot. I'm just going to the store. And then when I read that, get rid of that.
Yes, I
mean,
that,
it's like
yeah,
it's almost like a that, tick or something like
right.
that.
Right. It's like that like. Like over and over again.
Yes, yes. Which we probably don't do in writing as much as in speaking.
Right. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah, just doesn't, I don't think it adds too much. I think it could be substituted with something else. I am leaving now instead of I'm just leaving.
I find that it diminishes the action to say just doing this.
And it probably doesn't really mean, it's rather idiomatic. It doesn't really mean, just doesn't fit in there.
Right, right.
It's taken on a new meaning.
So that's why editing is very good to do.
Yes. Always.
I wonder
before
if,
you hit send.
Yeah. And still then, with spell checkers and grammar checkers, it often doesn't capture some of the very common errors of I often type O-U-R, but I'm thinking A-R-E, and then I'm very embarrassed when something goes out like that.
Do not trust spell check.
Do not.
Do not trust grammar check. Do not trust spell check. Certainly watch out for autocorrect, because that can really make a mess. it's best to get a human editor or to proofread something yourself, even if you have spell checked it, read it through, have somebody else read it through. There are services that are non-human that do a good job. Grammarly has one online. You pay a certain amount each month and you can submit a certain number of pages. And it's not human, but I think it's decent. I don't know. I have friends who use it.
Artificial intelligence.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's an oxymoron, artificial intelligence.
Right. Yes. I wonder if you also might talk a little bit about the active versus the passive voice and give us some examples of that.
Okay. And that is one of the things that does matter in writing. Active is if the subject of the sentence is doing the verb, such as she drove to school. She drove. She's doing the driving. The passive is she was driven to school. Whether or not you say she was driven to school by her brother or just she was driven to school, she didn't do anything. So that's passive. The rule is to use active most of the time. The times you would use passive are when you don't know who did it, because then you can't use active. For example, the school was built in 1970. Maybe you don't know who built the school, so you can't put it in active. Or if it's either you don't know who did it or you don't care. You're telling somebody the school was built in 1970. That's the important thing. It doesn't matter who built it. So you would use the passive. So if you don't know or it's not important, you can use the passive voice. Otherwise, it's much more direct and stronger to use the active.
Especially when you're trying to maybe showcase yourself.
Definitely.
Yes.
Yes.
Long sentences versus short sentences, I think, is there's certainly a style factor in that. But I don't know. Can you talk about that? Because long sentences require a little bit more punctuation, a little bit more actually tightness in the construction, I would think.
The best thing is when you're writing is to use both kinds. Short sentences often have more punch, but you want your sentences to be of varying length. Some people write with very long sentences and lots of commas. Long sentences do tend to get confusing. You'll get to some pronoun and you don't know what it refers back to. There's just too many phrases and clauses. So there is, I think, a maximum length of words that a sentence should be if it's really long. I'm not sure what it is. It's about 20 to 25. But some people think that just because they have a long sentence, that means it's a run-on. And those are two different things. You could have a sentence that's long enough to go around the equator, and it wouldn't be a run-on. It wouldn't be a good sentence, obviously. But as long as you used enough things to tie it together, it's not a run-on. And a run-on can be really short. Anything that is actually more than one sentence that doesn't have a period or a semicolon or a colon or a conjunction is a run-on. So you can make nice long sentences as long as they're clear.
And a run-on sentence, for our listeners who maybe don't remember,
okay.
Is?
Don't worry, be happy. It's four words, but if you don't put any punctuation in, don't worry is a sentence, be happy is a sentence, and a comma cannot separate as two sentences. A lot of people do that. That's a common thing, to try to separate two sentences with a comma. My students did it all the time. You can't do it unless you put and or
but. A semicolon.
Or you can put a semicolon if the two sentences are like, don't worry, be happy, they're related. Or you can put a period and a capital B for be happy. But yeah, you can fix them in a number of ways. But that's, you know, if I'm editing a novel or something, novels, you give a little leeway when somebody's writing fiction. Sometimes in informal writing, even in my books, you'll write something that's not a complete sentence, which is called a fragment, for effect. And if you know it's a fragment and you're doing it for a purpose, that's okay, and I'll let it go. I don't think I will ever let a run-on go, even in a novel. You got to put a semicolon rather than a comma. I will not let her. No run-ons.
The semicolon is my favorite.
Mine too.
Punctuation.
Mine too.
And sometimes I wonder if I use it excessively. Is there excessive use of the semicolon?
I guess there would be if you're connecting things that really aren't closely related enough and should have a period.
But it's when they are related and you want those thoughts to be together or they naturally follow. I don't know. I feel it's not used enough.
It's not used enough because people are very afraid of it because they don't know when to use it. They think it's some complicated punctuation mark or that it's related somehow to the colon. And really, the semicolon is a lot more closely related to a comma. A semicolon and a colon are not interchangeable at all.
Well, let's tell our listeners then the correct use of the semicolon, just so I could validate that I'm using it correctly,
okay.
Since I've already confessed I use it all the time.
There are actually two main uses of a semicolon. The first is to connect two sentences that are closely related. If you don't want to use a conjunction to tie them or you don't want to put a period, for example, I graduated Harvard, my sister graduated Yale. Those are very closely related. You'd put a semicolon between them, most likely, instead of making them two short sentences. You could put a but or an and, or you could use a semicolon.
So they can stand alone.
They can stand
alone. They have
alone.
The elements
yes.
of standalone
yes.
sentences, yes. But since we mentioned the colon, which is unrelated grammatically to the semicolon, but they look alike, you know, I mean, that's
yes.
maybe the only reason they're called the colon and the semicolon because of the typewriter. I don't know. But in a sentence, tell us when and how you do use the colon.
A colon means something else is coming. So a colon is most commonly used to introduce a list.
But something else is coming, but it's not another sentence.
It can be another sentence.
Oh.
It can be another sentence. You can actually, certain types of sentences that are closely related, you can connect with a semicolon. Certain pairs of sentences that are closely related, you can connect with a colon. I don't recommend it because it's more difficult to figure out which ones, because if you use it wrong, it's just all off. If the second sentence follows as a result of the first, you can put a colon between them. But most commonly, it's introducing a list. You can use it before a long quote, but you can't use it if you have, let's say you have a list of things in a sentence. The ingredients were. Well, if you said the ingredients were as follows, you'd put a colon and you'd list them. But if you said the ingredients were flour, sugar, eggs, you don't put a colon after the verb. Generally, I think the rule is you don't put a colon after a verb. That's just splitting the sentence. That's not really an introduction to a list.
So since we're talking about lists, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is bullet points. If this falls into your rubric. Because bullet points are, I think, a convention that has grown as a result of desktop publishing and word processing and that sort of thing. Probably we never used them before. Maybe we did. I don't know. But I sometimes struggle with punctuation within a bullet-pointed list. And maybe nobody really cares, but I get hung up on it sometimes when I'm creating a bullet-pointed list. And do you have any thoughts or opinions about that?
Yes, I have an opinion about everything. I think bullet lists are great, and I think they're used more commonly now because there's so much information around. It's just easier to pick things up if they're listed in a bulleted list. It's just a easy way to convey information. Punctuation in a bullet list. Well, a bullet list, first of all, should be what we call parallel. So if one item in your list is a sentence, all the items in your list should be sentences. And they should all be constructed the same way. And if they're not sentences, they should still be constructed the same way. For example, we learned the following things in class. and you have a list of a bulleted list. Speaking in Spanish, reading in Spanish, how to diagram sentences. That's not parallel. You want to keep them so they're all the same. Punctuation-wise, if they're sentences, they get periods at the end. If they're not sentences, they do not need periods at the end. But some lists start off, even if they're vertical lists rather than being in a sentence. In this class, we learned how to. You don't actually need a colon there, even if you've got a vertical list of the bulleted list. And those items actually finish the sentence.
With a period at the
end? So you can put a period at the end of each of them. Yes.
Esoteric, yes. But when you're creating bullet point lists, or when I am, I want to get it right. And I think that it's the consistency that actually helps get points across. Because if you're inconsistent, a reader of that list may not know what's wrong, but that inconsistency, I think, dilutes what you're trying to get across.
I agree. Yeah. Consistency is really important in everything. Consistency, if you're not consistent, people will get confused. They won't know what you meant. And if certain types of inconsistency, they'll think you don't know what you're doing. You can't decide.
Or that you're cutting and pasting from somebody
right.
else's list. and you may be doing that, but at least take the time to clean it up. I'm talking with Arlene Miller. She's the grammar diva. The best little grammar book ever is her best-selling book. I think I'm going to call it that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Getting Your Grammar, Punctuation, and Word Usage Right, another book. And I have some more things I actually feel like I want to address because I'm curious about.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang here with the grammar diva herself, Ms. Arlene Miller. We'll take a short break. Stay with us. Or is it the incomparable? Britney Spears with her cover of the Rolling Stones' Satisfaction. Let's get back to my conversation with the grammar diva Arlene Miller. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea.
Since we've talked about some of my own issues, and we're going to continue on that list since I have the diva with me. Parentheses. Another thing I think I tend to use a lot, but I feel that sometimes they're essential, or that they bracket off or highlight a point, and other times I think, no, you've used it pointlessly. So I want to know what you think about parentheses, using them within a sentence, bracketing off a sentence, and then punctuation in or outside the parentheses, if you could wrap your head around
okay.
any of that.
Parentheses. You know, it's really arbitrary whether or not you think something belongs in parentheses. It's kind of, there's no rule. unless, I mean, if you're saying Ralph Smith and you want to give the years of his life, it goes in parentheses right after his name. Other things, sometimes there are options. Instead of parentheses, sometimes you can use the dash, which is often really overused. Sometimes you can put whatever it is in parentheses, I mean in commas, within two commas, as long as it's not a complete sentence, then it needs to go in parentheses. I don't use them that often. I don't really think about them. The punctuation of them is often an issue. Sometimes you'll put parentheses around an entire sentence. And in that case, you can have it be its own sentence, and the punctuation would go inside the closing parentheses. Other times, people like to put commas before or after the parentheses. And unless there would be a comma there anyway, that you don't need any other punctuation.
My sister and I have arguments about grammar sometimes. And we have come down on different sides of having, am I going to be able to think of an example? Like, we went to the lake together, but I didn't have a good time. And I put the, but I didn't have a good time in parentheses, which might not be a good example of using parentheses, but the period, would it go inside or outside the
That would go outside.
She wins.
Because the period goes with the entire sentence.
With the entire sentence. Yeah.
What's in parentheses isn't an entire sentence. It doesn't get the period.
Okay. All right. My sister always wins those things, you know.
So she wins that one.
She wins that one. And something that I do want to talk with you just briefly about pronouns. I find that sometimes in listening to people, and this is mainly in conversation, that we are getting less specific about what we're talking about. And he went there, they did that. You know, without being specific, even describing things sometimes, describing activities or places, or I feel that we are getting less specific in our description of the world around us and our interactions. And I wonder if that's your experience.
Lazy.
Laziness. Yeah. That's what it is sometimes. I find that when I'm talking to people sometimes and they're describing something and, well, it went here and, well, where? What? What went where? And I just wonder what that's all about.
In writing, it's completely unacceptable. And if I'm editing something, it's like, well, where, what does this mean, this? Or, you know, you don't want that this or which, that you don't know where it goes. In conversation, people must assume you know what they're talking about.
It's that
Hopefully
assumption.
Hopefully they know what they're talking about, yes. But I guess they just assume, and it just kind of flies by, and you don't think of what you're going to say, like when writing.
Just a little less thoughtful. Well, anything, I think we've covered a lot of my little bugaboos, and I'm wondering what you are seeing as trends in how people are writing and maybe in things that are loosening up and things that aren't loosening up.
One thing that is loosening up, well, there's the who and whom thing that apparently has been argumented since the revolution. When Noah Webster, and I wouldn't know this if I weren't just reading that book, said that we can just say, who did you go with? Because that's what people said, and why not? And now there are people that want to do away with the distinction between who and whom. And those of us who know the distinction want to prove our superiority by not getting rid of it. So the who and whom thing is kind of that's still being that's may not go away.
And tell us what that is.
Oh, the difference?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's a whole grammar lesson. There are tricks to try to figure it out. But basically, who is used as a subject when you would use something like he or she or I or we, and whom is used when it's an object and is used as you would use him or us or me. So sometimes in the sentence you can kind of substitute and see if you would use he or him, and that's how you can figure out if you would use who or whom. And some people use whom instead of who just to overcorrect, the same way people use I instead of me to overcorrect. One thing that has changed that is acceptable that I will not use, what I will not do, is the singular they. We don't have a singular pronoun that is non-gender specific and refers to people. We have he and we have she. So people will say things like, everyone is bringing their books. Now, everyone sounds plural, but it's not, because we say everyone is. He is, she is. It's a singular verb. Everyone is singular. And when you say everybody is bringing their lunch, there refers back to everybody, so it should also be singular. And the correct way to say it would technically be everyone is bringing his or her lunch. And it's clunky. So it is now acceptable to use there. I think there is plural. I don't like it. So there's always a way to rewrite the sentence to just avoid it. Everyone is bringing lunch. Everyone is bringing a lunch. All the people are bringing lunches.
Because then I think where I get confused then is, well, if it's there, then that's plural. And, it can get confusing.
It can. And it's an issue of agreement. The subject is singular. The verb needs to be singular because of agreement. If a noun is singular, the pronoun that refers to it needs to be singular. However, the his or her, people were doing his/her. They were just using he, and now that's not politically correct to just use he. People would put he and then she in parentheses and all kinds of things that didn't really work. So they just said, well, just use there. And there are, I think, colleges trying to now develop a non-gender specific pronoun, mostly because of the transgender population rather than for grammar's sake.
Interesting. Yeah. That and nobody wants to really be called an it.
Right. So. But dogs and cats, as much as you hate to call your pet an it, they are its.
They are its.
Yes.
Oh, darn.
Yes.
Well, Arlene, the Grammar Diva, why don't you tell our listeners how they could connect with you? I think you provide a lot of good information. And so tell our listeners how they can connect with you.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I have a website that is bigwords101.com. I may be changing it, but you'll always be able to get to it through bigwords101.com. Or also you can type in the Grammar Diva. I think you will also get there. On my website, I guess there's my email. You can email me grammar questions anytime. I always email the answers back. And I do a weekly blog that comes out once a week on sometime on the weekend about grammar and other and word issues.
And I recommend subscribing to that because very thoughtful.
This week's is interesting. The Oxford Dictionary has just added a 1,000 new words, and the Oxford English Dictionary just added 500. They are different. They're both published by the Oxford University Press. But the Oxford Dictionary is informal, much more informal than the Oxford English Dictionary. And the Oxford Dictionary, which does print slang words, has just added 1,000 words, among them some really strange ones like butt dialing, which is now a word. And manspreading, which is now a word, and cakeage, and all kinds of strange words. So I just did a blog post about it.
That just left me speechless, actually.
Even the Oxford English Dictionary, the authority of the English language, added some things that I don't remember any of them, but things that are fairly slang-like. Blu-ray got added. That's not slang, but that's one that I remember.
Manspreading and butt dialing.
Yes. Hangry. Hangry, which is you're so hungry that you're angry. Words are wonderful things.
Words are wonderful things. And grammar is a wonderful tool to have. And whether you're a reader or a writer, or we all communicate, and it can be fun and interesting. And I sure thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for inviting me.
My conversation with Arlene Miller. I urge you to subscribe to her blog at bigwords101.com. I can't leave without playing one of my favorite songs by the Gershwins, sung by Ella and Louie. And we'll go out on what we opened the show with, It Ain't Necessarily So, performed by the great lady of jazz, Mary Lou Williams.
Things have come to a pretty pass. Our romance is growing flat. For you like this and the other, while I go for this and that. Goodness knows what the end will be. Oh, I don't know where I'm at. It looks as if we two will never be one. Something must be done.
You say either, I say either, you say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, and either, neither, let's call the whole thing off. Yes, you like potato, and I like potato. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato, let's call the whole thing off. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh, if we ever part, then that might break my heart. So if you like pajamas, I like pajamas. I'll wear pajamas, give up pajamas. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling off, off. Oh, let's call the whole thing off, yeah.
You say laughter and I say laughter. You say after and I say after. Laughter, laughter, after, after. Let's call the whole thing off. You like vanilla and I like vanilla. You sarsaparilla and I sarsaparilla. Vanilla, vanilla, or chocolate, strawberry. Let's call the whole thing off. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh, if we ever part, then that might break my heart. So if you go for oysters and I I'll order oysters and cancel the oysters. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of off. Let's call the whole thing off.
Yes, you say either.
And you say either.
You say neither.
And you say neither.
Either.
Either.
And either.
And neither.
Let's call the whole thing off. Oh, yes. You like potato.
And you like potato.
You like tomato.
And you like tomato.
Potato.
Potato.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Let's call the whole thing off.
But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh,
so if you like potato.
pajamas.
Nice pajamas.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of home. Let's call the home.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and we've just enjoyed some grammatically incorrect music. It Ain't Necessarily So, played by Mary Lou Williams, recorded at Keystone Corner. And before that, Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong with another Gershwin standard, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. Earlier in the broadcast, we spoke with Arlene Miller, the grammar diva. Visit her website at bigwords101.com. Visit our website at krcb.org. Listen to our podcast or subscribe and listen on iTunes. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.